I'm David Smith, and you're listening to the Faith in Teaching podcast from the Kaiser Institute for Christian Teaching and Learning at Calvin University. In this series, we'll be talking with researchers and educators who are working to understand how Christian faith affects teaching, learning, and the way we do education. And this is a little bit of a milestone podcast because this is the first time we have a repeat visitor to the podcast. And with me today is Kevin Garry, who's a professor of education at Valparaiso University in Indiana. Kevin, thank you for rejoining us.
Thank you for having me, David.
And the reason Kevin's here is that he has a new book out. It's on an intriguing topic, and so it seemed like we should have a conversation about it. So, Kevin, tell us about the book. What's going on with the book?
Sure. So the book is called titled Why Boredom Matters, Education, Leisure, and the Quest for a Meaningful Life. And, you know, it's something that parents and teachers are contending with all the time. And I wrote a paper a few years ago and was trying to bring together John Dewey, who's very much about how can we make education interesting, and also then bring together people like Soren Kierkegaard, who writes about, you know, despair and boredom quite directly. And so trying to think about the bored mind and pairing that with what Joseph Pieper calls the leisurely mind. And in the book, I'm taking that further. And so what I'm doing in the book is I'm also, you know, there's just been in the last 20 years a lot of research in psychology on boredom, understanding the bored state and parsing it. Are there different kinds of boredom? And then going deeper into what I describe in the book as kind of a Sabbath leisure mindset, which I really see as kind of the antithesis or opposite of the bored mind. So instead of being a bored person, we actually can cultivate a leisurely way of engaging with the world. And leisure not in the sense of let's go on a vacation, but leisure in a way of attending to and being present. So that's kind of the broad argument of the book, but really it comes back to just the fundamental problem that parents and teachers have when their kids say I'm bored, and we can feel like it's something that we need to figure out and solve. And so it's really trying to provide some practical wisdom about how to contend with this enduring and troubling mood state.
So it's part of what's fascinating here. We're already three philosophers in and into our conversation, and yet we're also talking about, you know, parents needing to entertain their kids. So where's the heart of this view? Like, why does boredom matter? It seems to me it's one of these things that's around us all the time. It's in everybody's classroom, and yet I don't actually see a ton of books and articles on it, right? It's not like one of the hot topics, and yet it's everywhere. So what makes this worth digging into further as a topic?
You're right. It's pervasive, and I would say it's also an enduring problem. And we can trace accounts of boredom, or even descriptions of boredom. There may have been a different word to name it. You know, the ancient precursor of boredom is acedia. And when you read, you know, in Evagrius, what a monk who's suffering with acedia sounds like a bored student in a classroom in 2022. And so it's an enduring just mood state that human beings have had to contend with. It's sometimes described as the latent emotion, meaning it sort of flies under the radar. And I think that's why it's there, but we can kind of navigate our way out of it. You know, Walker Percy describes modern life as a boredom avoidance scheme. And so, you know, we think of like a mood or an emotion like anger, we can, you know, recognize it. Often it's very explicit when we see someone angry. And anger, we have to figure out how are we going to, you know, what kind of relationship are we going to have with the emotion of anger. Boredom, we may not even really be paying attention to how we're navigating or responding to boredom. And that's the problem. And so I think there are just two key problems. The one is when confronted with boredom, we tend to avoid it. And so that's kind of pervasive. And certainly technology has aided and abetted that in countless ways. The other problematic way we respond to boredom is we resign ourselves to it. And I'm thinking of context in teaching where I would have to observe teachers, primarily middle school, high school, but sometimes elementary. And oftentimes the teaching would be dreadfully boring. And I would be kind of amazed at the students because I'd expect I actually was hoping there'd be a revolution. You know, I, like this teacher should be penalized for this boring classroom. And instead, the students were surprisingly docile and obedient. And I would describe it more accurately as they were resigned. So they were in a situation that was boring. And rather than seeing possibilities for how to, you know, change it, they just accepted it and resigned themselves. And so you've got this sort of this kind of the opposite ways of handling it. One is to find ways to avoid it, or the other is to just resign ourselves to it. And I think there's just a lack of agency that comes with that. And so it's this, it's this enduring, persistent problem that we need to take a careful look at. And so that's why I'm focusing on it like this.
So I was glad to see you acknowledge early in the book that, you know, sometimes boredom in schools really is just because the teacher is boring, right? And because the classroom is a dreadfully dreary environment, and so there's plenty there to justify the presence of boredom. I sat at the back of a middle school class a few years back and watched a whole group of middle school students sit for 35 minutes copying down bullet point sentences from a PowerPoint screen, and sat there marveling at the end and thinking they probably think they were being really good students. This is part of the deal. So it seems to me sort of, you know, superficially one might think, okay, if the problem is that school is boring and that students get bored, then the answer is to make school less boring. And you're sort of digging, you're kind of going around that and say, no, there's something else going on. So what's the case for not settling at this level of, well, the class is boring, liven up the class?
Yeah, so I think boredom is just, again, it's an enduring mood state, and we're going to have to contend with it. I think the ideal of the progressive educator, I'm thinking of like Summerhill and Dewey, and not Dewey, I think Dewey is much subtler than this, but the idea is that you would have a classroom where the mood state, the boredom mood state would just never arise. The teaching would be so engaging and meaningful that students would never experience boredom. And I just don't think that utopia exists. And I think trying to create that utopia actually creates a whole another, you know, slew of problems. And the real problem that it creates is, you know, sometimes it gets dubbed edutainment. You know, as a high school teacher for 10 years and now a college teacher, and it is a real thing. You can feel anxiety about boredom. If I'm boring students, there's going to be a whole other slew of problems. And so you're trying to constantly keep them engaged and stimulated. Let's watch this video clip. Let's do 5 minutes of this, 3 minutes of that. And the problem then is you are forming students into this boredom avoidance modality that really sets them up for a way of life. And this is part of our larger culture. And so teaching unwittingly is doing that when it's trying to avoid boredom. Conversely, if your classroom is very, very boring and students are copying PowerPoint sentences down as you described it, you're also then having them settle in a way and resign themselves and think of themselves as good students when they're not challenging or engaging with. And so part of the challenge for teachers is one is to get students or to guide students to attend to activities for sustained periods of time in ways that are actually, you know, that are interesting. And you know, to get good at anything, you're going to have to contend with boredom, to get good at an instrument, a language, a sport. And that's just part of the process. And the problem with boredom avoidance is it short circuits that. And so you never get to what is really good about this thing because you haven't given yourself the time to do that. And so teaching, you know, teachers, it's really hard work, though, to be guiding students to do that, but also then encouraging students to challenge boring contexts and situations. And so, you know, a simple question, a student saying, I do not understand what you're saying, or I don't understand the point of what it is we're doing. And you know, teachers, sometimes we are crafty at pushing away those questions. And the problem is if a student is thinking that, the bored state is soon to follow or already is active. And so encouraging students to name when they don't understand something, they don't see the point of something, is a way to really come at this problem more directly rather than sort of avoiding it, keeping it under the radar, and then developing these really problematic ways of engaging with it.
Mm-hmm. So if boredom avoidance is a problem, and I like the connection you made to consumerism in the book, right, that you know, teaching boredom avoidance is really just teaching students to be impatient consumers and to, you know, consume more of the technologies that society's created so that we never feel bored. One might be forgiven then for leaping to the opposite end and say, well, obviously I need to make my teaching as boring as possible because I need to grind some virtue into my students and it'll give them lots of chances to say, but why are we doing this, Professor Gary? So you're not saying that, right? So just clarify that for me. Like, where's the space between boredom avoidance and, I don't know, in current lingo, we might say being boredom positive, I guess, right. In terms of designing your classes.
Yeah. Well, you know, when you think of like, you know, modern day office cubicle life or factory life, where you're forced to do the same very repetitive task that has low cognitive, you know, those are contexts where human beings are bored, and the boredom is understood, and there should be a pushback against that. And so, on the other hand, there are other activities that there are all kinds of possibilities for engagement and acquiring or recognizing that you're going to need to be patient with math or with reading or with learning a language, because there are goods that will come. You know, initially you're not going to see what's the good of this. And so part of it is being very explicit in naming that for students. And that does require, you know, you can try to hook students in perhaps a little bit with interest, but the interest will flag and sort of pointing to things that just stay with me. And so part of that also, I think with good teaching, good teachers build trust. And if the students trust you, that can be leveraged for getting them to attend to something, whether it be, you know, a proof in geometry or, you know, a chemistry equation. If you trust me here, you're going to see that there is something beautiful and meaningful and worthwhile here. And so partly good teachers leverage that trust to guide students to attend just for a bit longer than the human mind is, you know, being conditioned to by this, you know, modern economy, so to speak. And so that's part of it. I mean, I think teachers have to use everything they've got, but the goal is this deeper attention to what it is that's in front of them. I mean, the other scourge of teaching, as we know, is grading. And the problem with grading is grading distracts your attention from the process to the carrot or star or sticker at the end. And, you know, the bored mind is a distracted mind. It's constantly looking away from what's in front of it. And this is where I get into leisure. The leisurely mind is able to attend to something and to begin to appreciate what's interesting and engaging about it. And the process of grading, and I'm not going to say we're going to turn grading off after this interview, teachers are going to stop grading. But the problem is it constantly directs our attention away from what it is we're attending to. And that's what the bored mind is being conditioned to do. So, David, this is a really difficult and challenging problem. But there are some, you know, I think systemic things that make it even more challenging.
Mm-hmm. So if we talk about, you talk about the bored mind, the leisurely mind, and then you've got a chapter on boredom and despair. That almost feels like quite a big change of register. Like I know that Kierkegaard is not the most cheerful philosopher in the canon, but tell us about that. The jump to despair. Yeah. That sounds like a fairly dramatic way of talking about boredom.
Yeah. So let me just go back a bit. So boredom, you know, is there's two. Heidegger's distinction is really helpful. He talks about there's situational boredom. I'm bored in a situation. I'm bored listening to this professor, I'm bored in this classroom. And so I'm situationally bored, but I can solve that. I can change the situation. It'll end. I'll move on to the next thing. I'll look to my phone. And then there's, you know, existential boredom, which Heidegger says is a more profound boredom. So I'm changing this situation, that situation, but I'm still finding, you know, there's a malaise. And so that's a deeper, more profound boredom. Heidegger is drawing on Kierkegaard and saying, you know, there's something deeper going on here. And Kierkegaard, you know, describes the self as afflicted by despair. And the simple definition of despair is that you're uncomfortable with yourself. And so to think of it, you know, he describes there's two different kinds of despair. One is the despair of necessity. The other is the despair of possibility. The despair of necessity is really failing to see anything can happen here. I'm stuck in a doctor's office. I'm waiting and I'm bored and I'm just, there's nothing to be done. And so I just sort of, you know, again, think of that student listening to the PowerPoints and copying them down. They resign themselves to this when in fact there could be possibilities for engagement. Now, in some cases there may not be. Maybe you need to be very direct or maybe you need to talk to your parents and somehow get out of this teacher's class. But nevertheless, that's a possibility that could be engaged with. There's some agency there. So, and, you know, in falling into despair, you're thinking of yourself as someone who is incapable of doing anything about anything, really. And so that's a deeper problem that Kierkegaard's diagnosing. The other despair is the despair of possibility. on the one hand, we think of possibility as this positive word. There's possibilities for everything, but the turn of mind is to forget about our own possibilities and to fixate on the possibilities of others. And so, you know, we see this fascination with the lives of others, and social media has opened up, you know, infinite avenues to scroll and just take in all kinds of media and watch shows and dwell in vicarious possibilities for others. And Kierkegaard said that also is a form of despair, because you're not thinking of a possibility for you in this situation that could challenge a necessity, and thereby, you know, you're an agent here. And in the book that I'm looking at activities or a way of entering leisurely activities, and these could be very mundane things. This could be washing the dishes, reading a book, going for a walk, where you can find this middle space between necessity or possibility, those variants of despair. I hope that didn't sound too abstract, but it really does undergird kind of this problem, and I think in a more profound way.
It's really interesting. I mean, it seems like you're trying to shift the locus from boredom is a problem because there isn't a scintillating thing going on in front of me, to boredom is a problem because of how I'm thinking about my own agency as a student in a classroom. And and that then relates back to formation, which brings me to the question. I mean, I think when we think about faith and learning conversations or conversations about Christian education, I don't really come across boredom as a subheading in those conversations either, right? So, you know, we don't think of this as something that we sort of have to deal with when thinking about Christianity and education. Where does this fit into that landscape?
So in the research on boredom in the last 15, 20 years, I'd say there are two trend lines. The one is just, you know, diagnostic, understanding the mood state and really withholding any kind of normative critique or judgment. It's saying boredom just is. It's a state of disinterest, of being understimulated, and it can be situational or it could be even more profound. And then some of those studies then link it to all these very problematic behaviors, addiction, overeating, gambling. The Christian tradition, going back to Evagrius, has this notion of acedia, which is the noonday devil. And again, this sounds a lot like boredom to me. And the phenomenology of acedia is, you know, mirrors boredom. But this is placing the bored state within the context of a whole different metaphysical worldview. And I think what's also really noteworthy about that is, you know, in our contemporary life, we say boredom is either neutral, or there's research saying, you know, boredom is actually a positive thing. If you're bored, you could be, it leads to creativity. It leads to, in the Christian worldview, boredom, acedia, is actually a morally perilous state. And so when we're bored, we need to be on high alert. The noonday devil, you know, coming at noon means that it comes unawares. It comes under the radar. You're doing this ordinary thing in the middle of the day, and somehow, you know, acedia, which was considered one of the eight deadly thoughts, which then get transformed into the seven deadly sins, the Christian tradition is putting us on high alert to say, if we're a bored person and we're avoiding boredom, we're probably entering into some morally treacherous territory. Unfortunately, you know, when the eight deadly thoughts were transformed into the seven deadly sins, acedia then gets, you know, situated within sloth. And sloth, we know, you know, has many connotations, but unfortunately the most popular connotation is sort of the slacker on the couch. C.S. Lewis talks about a very busy sloth. And I think that's more akin to what boredom is. Boredom is a busy, roving, restless mind that's on the lookout for something new. And so the Christian tradition, I think, has resources not only that are diagnostic, but also normative for thinking about how we contend with it. And the normative parts also then get at Sabbath and leisure. You know, we are Sabbath people, and this is drawing from the Jewish and Christian tradition, whether Saturday or Sunday, we are aiming to cultivate a Sabbath attentiveness. And the bored mind is a distracted mind, constantly on the lookout for what's new, whereas the leisurely Sabbath mind is able to enjoy simple things and to be renewed by simple things again and again and again. So going for a walk, having a conversation with your spouse, having a cup of tea and appreciating that, you know, versus having a cup of tea and looking at 50 tabs on your screen, which I actually have right now. And so really learning to cultivate that Sabbath attentiveness comes right out of a Christian tradition. So I think there's just really some wonderful normative wisdom for how to contend with a mood state that is morally precarious. As we think about, you know, why should this matter to Christian educators?
It strikes me that if we're deeply formed in this consumerist sort of, you know, high information flow kind of context, we're actually likely to find Sabbath boring, and the medicine becomes the part of the thing we're avoiding because we don't want to enter a space of attentiveness. So the connection to attentiveness is really interesting there. I wonder how many of our classes we actually have an intentional part of our lesson plan that says I'm going to do something to foster the capacity for attentiveness today.
And I think it's the key too is what we're attending to. So on the one hand, I think it needs to be things that have what I would describe, and this is drawing from Albert Borgman's work on technology. He describes there are certain activities that have they have a low threshold and the rewards come quite quickly. So when I'm looking at something online and I'm watching something on Netflix, I expect to be engaged right out of the gate. And if I'm not, I'm not going to watch this series. Whereas activities that involve leisure, and you think of the liturgy, you can think of, reading a book, there's a much higher threshold that we need to overcome to get to a much deeper, richer pleasure. The reward that comes from learning to read a good book is a much more profound reward. And the problem with, I think of my kids love to play video games, and they just say, well, that's my form of leisure. And the difference is that the video games are designed for the bored, distracted mind. They're constantly providing these dopamine hits so that you're never really attending very long on any one thing. The environments are just, multi-stimulated and sensory. And so I think, in terms of, how we approach teaching and learning, it's getting or guiding students to attend to something that's simple, that has a rich reward. And part of this, really involves being an apprentice because as bored students, as you said, church is boring and that's their judgment. And it's going to take time for them to be apprenticed into realizing, no, there's actually something here that's happening. And you're acquiring habits of attention that actually are the beginnings of a contemplative, prayerful, disposition. So
if I'm a teacher and I'm listening to this on the way to school, what's one piece of advice for why this matters for what I do in my classroom?
I think it really, going back to, I'm repeating myself now, David, but cultivating attention. So attending to something for a sustained period of time and creating space where students can even choose something they're going to attend to. So you're going to have, for the next 20 minutes, these are five different things you can do, but you have to do them for 10 to 15 minutes and just do that. I know this seems so simple and so basic, but when you go into classrooms today, students often aren't challenged to do that. They're given, oftentimes they have devices. They have a Chromebook where, I'm sitting in classrooms and you see the multiple tabs and the multiple, toggling that's happening. And so it just plays into the restiveness of the bored mind. And so anything that involves students being present to something for, a space of time is really then guiding them to appreciate the intrinsic goods of a practice. And so that's the goal. And then, again, as I said earlier, unfortunately, grading and marks take us away from the intrinsic goods, the process, really from attending to what's there. And so that would be the big takeaway that I would offer to teachers and parents as well. Thinking of bored kids, our kids come to us and say, Dad, Mom, I'm bored. And part of that is they just, again, the despair of necessity, they don't see possibilities, even though there are 1,000 possibilities. And so part of it is here are 4 things you can do. Do one for a period of time. And stick with that just for a bit of time. And so that would be something. And part of that is, saying here are 4 possibilities versus here are 4,000 possibilities. There's also the boredom of overstimulation that Robert Louis Stevenson talks about. And I think that's what we do to kids. Here are 4,000 things you can do. Here are 4 things you can do. Spend some time on each one of them. I'm repeating myself, but those are some takeaways.
That's good. It's a very rich topic. We've just about used up our time, but I'm thankful that you've given us a serious book on this whole cluster of edutainment, stimulation, boredom, despair, agency, and just helping us to think through what a good state might be, and therefore what formation might look like, what we might actually be trying to get to. I suspect some of us are trying to get to the wrong thing, and you're helping us see that. So I've been talking here with Kevin Garry. His new book is called Why Boredom Matters, Education, Leisure, and the Quest for a Meaningful Life. It's out with Cambridge University Press. came out in July this year, and yeah, really interesting set of topics. So so go take a look if you need a book to save you from your boredom at this moment in time. So thank you, Kevin, for coming back and talking to us about boredom.
Thank you, and I promise the book is interesting. So
I second that.
You've been listening to the Faith in Teaching podcast from the Caius Institute for Christian Teaching and Learning at Calvin University. Learn more at www.pedagogy.net.